You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. And pollock was the big fish in the headlines this week as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released its 2025 Eastern and Northern Bering Sea Bottom Trawl Survey. According to the new federal survey data, the biomass of pollock in the Eastern Bering Sea off of the U.S. state of Alaska has fallen to 3.8 million metric tons. That's a 30% year-on-year decline and well below the long-term average of 4.6 million metric tons. Undercurrent's Masahiko Takeuchi reported this week that the sharp drop contrasts with the largely steady Bering Sea pollock total allowable catch that the Council's Scientific and Statistical Committee recommended late last month, based on the 2024 assessment.
And important to note here is that the use of the 2024 assessment was only due to the federal government's 43-day shutdown.
Exactly. That survey also highlighted a large drop in age-structured abundance, with total abundance declining 36%. Moss has got a great breakdown of the survey, and the link to read it is in their show notes.
I've got more bad pollock news.
Oh, it's going to be one of those episodes, huh?
So U.S. fish jerky startup Neptune Snacks has shut down after 6 years.
The pollock jerky?
The pollock jerky.
No.
I know. UCN editorial director Cliff White broke the devastating news this week that U.S. fish jerky maker Neptune Snacks has been shuttered by its owners, Nick Mendoza and Garrett Delgado. The two have both moved on to other jobs, and Neptune's products, which included four types of jerky made from Alaska pollock and Pacific rockfish sourced from the U.S. Pacific Northwest, have since left store shelves. But there's potential for some good news here.
Okay, we'll take what we can get. Let's hear it.
So Mendoza said discussions are underway that could lead to Neptune finding a new home with an established seafood company. But nothing's been finalized, he said. Ending operations was both painful and necessary, and the culmination of mounting pressures that ultimately overwhelmed the creative energy that led him to launch the brand.
You gotta do what's right for you.
Exactly, but still a shame. I think that it might have been the first fish jerky experience that I ever had.
In Boston, right? A few years back or no?
Is that at the Gap? I think it might have been at the Gap conference.
Oh, yes.
They were in like the swag bags. I think that was the first time I got them. And then we Lauren and I used to have our show, Watch Us Eat, where we had the jerky on there at
we
one
sure
point.
Did.
But yeah, I think that was the first fish jerky experience I ever had. And I've had so many more since then, but I really enjoyed that one. It had a really good chew to it.
It did. And it had such a hot start too. They attracted advisors that included a former Frito-Lay product developer to help overcome potential stigmas around fish being turned into jerky.
And it did land at retail in the seafood department rather than among meat snacks, which Mendoza said its sales outperformed expectations, which I get that they wanted to compete with the other meat jerky and snacks out there, so you'd want to, you know, be by those other options. But is the person that's going to that aisle going to take a chance on fish jerky? You know, I really don't know. So it makes sense to me why you'd find success by the seafood, because that's where all the seafood lovers are going to be. So, you know, when you talk about snack meats, that's always been brought up in the past couple of years, that the seafood's always trying to infiltrate the snack market. Mm-hmm. We never really hear it being by the seafood counter. You know, like you have the cold stuff, like the snack boxes, like the Acme came out with like the lox in a box. You know, obviously those have to be in the cold storage area, but like the fish jerky, it's not.
Right,
cold.
It doesn't have to be refrigerated or anything.
Yeah.
So,
but it still makes sense, you know? Like, you know, when you go to think about now the convenience store factor and gas stations, though, there's no other option there. But that is interesting to think about the retail side of things at the food store. But I digress. Problems came up that led to the company's demise, including a big setback in the form of a total loss fire that destroyed a cold storage facility containing nearly all of its product. And that was just 2 days after the company had learned that it had been accepted into its first 100 store retail chain.
Yikes, that is not great timing.
Not at all. And then enter the COVID-19 pandemic.
The pandemic made some companies and broke some companies.
It was a break in this case. As we all know, when the COVID era supply chain crisis hit, prices on store shelves, they rose sharply.
Whatever you could find on store shelves.
Exactly. What a time. What a time to be alive. But the whole thing feels like a fever dream at this point. But during that COVID period, Neptune frequently found itself locked into contracts that prevented it from raising its own prices. And Mendoza told Undercurrent that retailers and distributors absorb margins that once belonged to the brand, while distributor payment delays stretch as long as 200 days and demanded constant attention. So I've got a link in the show notes. Check out the full story. And hopefully in the new year, we can come back with an update about Neptune Snacks finding a new home.
It's got such a good sustainability story, so I hope that's the case.
And that gives me an idea for a podcast episode. Our 2026 wish list.
We're already starting that, huh?
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what's on my wish list.
Okay.
The end to all the tariff craziness.
Hear, hear.
So U.S. seafood giant Bumblebee Foods and retailer Costco have joined a growing number of firms suing to preserve their rights to a refund if President Donald Trump's tariffs are determined to be illegal. San Diego, California-based Bumblebee, which is owned by Taiwan's FCF company, is one of the three largest U.S. canned tuna companies with around $1 billion in annual revenue. On November 18th, it filed a lawsuit against Customs and Border Protection in the U.S. Court of International Trade, demanding tariffs implemented under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, also known as the IEEPA, be ruled illegal. The company is also asking for a full refund.
So Washington State headquartered Costco, the largest warehouse club chain in the United States with 114 stores, and a personal favorite of Lauren and I's.
There's only one place you can buy lobster mac and cheese, sweatpants, a new Korean face serum, a 3-month supply of toilet paper, and leave with a churro.
We love you, Costco. So the wholesale club chain had $275.2 billion in revenue in its most recent fiscal year, which ended August 31st. And on Monday, they filed a nearly identical lawsuit to Bumblebee. Neither Bumblebee nor Costco revealed in their filings how much they have paid in duties. But Costco Chief Financial Officer Gary Millerchip said on an investor call in May that about a third of Costco's sales in the U.S. are imported products.
There's a whole lot more to that story, so I encourage you to visit undercurrentnews.com to check out the full thing. But it's interesting you say that about Costco sales, because that's going to be something to keep an eye on in 2026 if a shift away from imported product occurs. That's one of the food trend predictions from online grocer Fresh Direct. They predict that 2026 will be the year of Made in the USA. According to Fresh Direct, consumers are paying close attention to where their food hails from, specifically seeking options from U.S.-based brands in order to source locally and support American-made businesses.
We've got our trends, predictions, and forecast type roundups for 2026 coming in the next few weeks, Lauren, so don't give away too much.
All right, I'll stop there. So more to come.
Back to tariffs. The U.S. President Donald Trump administration has extended its exemptions for 25% tariffs on frozen haddock fillets and flatfish sole from China for another year. The U.S. Office of the Trade Representative announced the move in a notice published in the Federal Register and dated Monday, December 1st, declaring Section 301 tariff exclusions earlier granted for 178 products from China, including 10 seafood harmonized tariff schedule codes, were being extended until November 10th of 2026. Lauren, explain to us what this means.
We've got a little bit of a sigh of relief here. So the USTR action offers meaningful short-term relief for U.S. importers of twice frozen haddock and sole from China. Both categories had been preparing for a potential tariff snapback at the end of November, which would have immediately lifted landed costs. The extension removes that near-term risk and allows supply chains to continue operating without a sudden cost shock.
Our very own Jason Huffman crunched the numbers, and based on his review of the 2024 U.S. import data, the latest action impacts about 20,562 metric tons of seafood from China, worth almost $115 million annually. And this is a super data-heavy story, so we're going to just leave you with that little tease, but check out the full story in the show notes. Now, Lauren, would you participate in the Squid Games?
The reality challenge show that's on Netflix, yes.
Okay, but the original deal. If I kidnapped you in the middle of the night, Lauren. So I don't think I'd be able to hang, honestly. But one lobster woman from PEI, Vanessa Clement, she just competed in the second season of Squid Games, the challenge on Netflix.
Lobster harvesting is tough, so I can see that. You go, girl.
Yeah, so the reality competition series is based on the Netflix South Korean drama of the same name. And just like the TV show, it brings together 456 players to live in a dorm-style setting and compete in games to win a prize of a whopping $4.56 million.
Did she win?
She did not. But she made the final four and did bring some attention to the Canadian lobster industry.
Hey, that's a win in itself.
Exactly.
Joining us now on the pod to talk more lobster is Undercurrent reporter Barb Dean Simmons and Price reporters Gary Morrison and Ben Fisher.
Barb, Gary, Ben, how far would you make it in the Squid Games?
I'm not even at the start line.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Ben, how do you think you'd fare?
I don't like heights, so poorly.
All right. All right.
You're talking about the real Squid Games or?
Lauren already siloed herself into the fake games, but I think Gary could probably compete in the real deal.
I think that'd do pretty well.
So the real reason we have you guys on the pod today is to talk lobster, not squid. So Barb, let's start with you. The new season of Canada's biggest lobster fisheries is currently underway. Where are we at with landings from the first week?
Well, sources tell me that landings in the first week were a little bit off. Of course, we had a couple of bad weather days in there, and certainly a bad weather day this week as well. But they're saying that it's not just the landings are off a little bit, but the quality was not as good as they expected as well. Maybe about 20% of the lobsters are not at that hard shell stage that would make it, you know, the best for the market. So that's the big picture. And of course, landings reports from Canada, we don't get them until well after the season is ended when we get the actual numbers because of the reporting system. So most of this is anecdotal from the buyers, from the guys at the wharves. But yeah, it's been a bit of a slow start in terms of landings.
Now, I'm sure like weather-wise, this has to be probably typical for this type of year, but is there anticipation moving forward that, you know, things are going to ease up a little bit? Do you kind of get that sense of feeling?
Yeah, weather's really the big player in all this for sure. We just came out of a nor'easter yesterday, which, you know, basically dumped a whole pile of wind, snow, and rain on Nova Scotia, which is the big lobster fishing area. And that will likely persist through the season until we get into the spring. The other thing about the season so far, which may see people pulling back a little bit fishing, is that the dock prices have dropped quite a bit from the start last year. And some guys might decide to wait until later in the season to really go hard at this fishery because they do have until April, May to wrap this up. So there's a few balls in the air, as we might say, a few things at play that could impact this as we go forward.
Thanks, Barb. And that brings us right to Gary and Ben. You brought up pricing from the price standpoint with the holidays right ahead of us. How's lobster faring?
Well, it's faring a lot better than last time I was on the podcast, if you're on the buying side, that is. So last time we chatted a few weeks back, lobster prices were through the roof. And for hard shells, for example, you weren't going to find wholesale prices coming under about 10 bucks a pound for anything except a cull. But now the tides have turned. So as Barb mentioned, the Canadian season, the biggest lobster fishing areas have kicked off. Canadian hard shells are coming into the U.S. now at about $2 cheaper than last year, according to one of my sources. And that's for a couple of reasons. One of those Barb touched on, the shipping quality isn't great. So instead of going to Beijing, maybe going to Boston is a little bit safer, closer. But also worldwide demand is subpar. Canadian exports to China, for example, are down due to tariffs on Canadian seafood. And then also processors in Canada haven't been buying all that aggressively. And that's due to some liquidity issues that we've reported on in recent months. So it makes a lot of sense for these Canadian hard shells to be sent to the U.S. market, where they've been in short supply.
So yeah, I mean, and it's certainly influencing prices on the tail and meat market, right? So we talked about the quality issues. Those lobster aren't being sent to some of the more desirable markets as live lobster, because that's where you would get more premium money. That means there's going to be more for processing. And that means more tails, more meat here in the U.S. So in anticipation, as we started seeing these initial reports of quality issues, buyers here in the U.S. have started to stall a little bit. And this is typically a time where we do see increased activity given the year-end holidays, but it's just not living up to expectations right now. And we can certainly see that in pricing. While it's not completely falling off, the expectation of increased supply is certainly softening the market. We did see some targeted changes on tails this week to the downside, and it's certainly being eyed as we move forward in the season. Additional supply coming into the U.S. can soften prices even further. Some contacts report that we that they think that pricing is going to be significantly below as we get into Q1 from where we are now. Again, there's some factors that we have to watch to see if that plays out, and it's certainly supply being one of them. But if you look at our pricing table, it's pretty compressed. You can go from the main prime sizes, four, five to eights, all the way up to the larger sizes, and you're pretty much at parity on all sizes, which gives buyers a little leeway if they want to make pricing decisions.
Canadian supply has softened the live hard shell price on the U.S. wholesale market as well. Everything from hard shell culls to 1¾ pounds can be had for under $10 a pound. So an average of anywhere between $7.75 and $9.60 a pound at that wholesale level, well under that double-digit mark that we'd seen in October when hard shells peaked in the States.
Yeah, I think the industry, this is a welcome sign, right, Ben? I mean, pricing at the beginning of last year and into this part of the year has certainly been elevated, and I think there was concerns moving forward that consumer spending might wane as the economy starts to shift a little bit here, as job losses seem to be accelerating. So these higher priced items certainly needed a little bit of help as we see some cautiousness in consumers.
Yeah, it's definitely a welcome sign from dealers who, they talked about a bit of a small bump for the Thanksgiving holiday, but they're already looking toward the end of the year, Christmas and New Year's. And if lobster stays at these levels, they are certainly hoping to move a lot of it.
In terms of the volume that's coming out of those big Canadian winter seasons, in 2023, the last year for which we have data, landings data from Canadian sources, those LFAs 33 and 34, they accounted for 24,800 metric tons of lobster. And that's about a quarter of what Canada catches annually. So that'll give you a sense of the volume that could be coming out of those Canadian fisheries for this season.
As always, deep dives into all this charts, information, all the data you want at the tips of your fingers is available on undercurrentnews.com. Thank you, Barb, Ben, Gary. Thanks for joining us to talk lobster. Gary, we're going to keep you on to talk shrimp. This week, you reported that prices have stalled. Can you share more insight?
The market was basically on a sugar high from higher cost from the tariffs rallied into this part of the year. But buyers really have slowed their buying. I think there's a couple of dynamics here at play, right? If you look at some of the export data from some of our major source nations, India, Ecuador, in October, they started to ship significantly more volume again out of their country, and the U.S. is a preferred destination. In addition, we have Indonesia back on, right? They're starting to ship to the U.S. and
Yeah, they just surpassed 300 shipments of certified radionuclide-free shrimp. And I'm going to include this picture. Gary, I don't know if you saw this picture, but the picture they have is so funny. It's these workers, and they're all waving goodbye to this truck of certified shrimp. And it's just the, turning a bad thing into a good thing. I love it. But yeah, they just passed 300 shipments. And because it was October 31st that the FDA put that hard stop.
In the beginning of the year, we had a glut of front loading of supply. And then we had a rally, based on smaller shipments into the US in those months after June, July. But it seems like now importers are starting to get aggressive again because they see what's coming down the pike, right? So, stuff that shipped out in October from Ecuador will take a few weeks to get here, from India and Indonesia a little longer. But there's that worry of another glut of supply hitting the market at a time when buying activity is slowing down significantly. And we first started seeing the weakness in the commodity, type product forms, headless shell on, head on, shell on. There really hasn't been much demand from the U.S. consumer for those product forms. So those product forms started to correct 2 to 3 weeks ago. But it since spilled over into some of the other categories that were holding pretty strong. Your peeled and deveined and things like that. So the value added that the U.S. consumer shifted to, now we're starting to see broader weakness, and it's accelerating here in the last week or two. And again, there's the concern that we have supply here that has been really not, I wouldn't call it overly burdensome, but certainly above what is needed. And the higher prices were mostly driven by higher costs and not a broad demand rally. So as that market seems to try to find equilibrium, things are starting to shift a little bit to the buy side.
Thanks again to all our friends who joined us on the podcast today. And don't forget to tune back in here next week, because we're going to have Gary back on, along with our fellow price reporters, Lauren Castiglione and Ben Fisher, to talk more about 2026.